The butterflies never stopped fluttering. Certain ones needed to catch their breath, and rightly so. They worked their arses off last time, creating colourful, hopeful beauty. But out there, the writers and the cartoonists and the bikers and the live streamers and the podcasters, they carried on. We didn't reach this point, a crucial point, because of the approved Yes Hubs and the hope over another Sheridan disaster, the rise and fall of new vehicles from certain lefty sects proclaiming this unified unity, and the Yes Orate. No, butterflies have been at work, busily creating Yes too. A wide range of folks singing, tweeting, Facebooking and stickering across Scotland. Butterflies who ask for nothing more than the right for a country that is ran for the good of all, and not by the few for their pockets. For healthcare, education and the right to work. Totally divorced from the committees and the self-elected leaders of Yes groupings who meet in offices or around tables to listen to sage men telling them how this is going to happen. Or not. The creatives, the multicoloured butterflies, are the ones continuing. They don't have a column in a newspaper, a book published, or a black book of contacts. They won't be noticed by the Yes Orate, those who are making a living out of the campaign. They have the internet, their hands and their voices, and if you look, they still have their stickers on their cars and their Yes signs in their windows. We from our lefty newspapers and millionaire and political party funded campaigns offered them hope. That hope didn't dissolve when we went to lick our wounds or build the next vehicle for a Yes personality campaign leech. Hope to them was not just a slogan a committee decided was rather good after seeing Obama use it. No. Real hope lived on and is blossoming on the streets as Yes 2 stickers and badges and posters and t-shirts and Etsy and Facebook and Twitter and blogger accounts and rallies and graffiti and art and song happen. Why do we want Yes? Because we're internationalists. Nationalism does not describe this movement. Nationalism pulls the butterflies into an ever-tightening net. That isn't us. We are internationalist butterflies. Fluttering without a net. We welcome the world. We beg Westminster to send the refugees to safety we can give them. We will do our bit. We beg of our government to share the wealth and the profit and the land. We are internationalist butterflies. We will use our wealth to create equality, aspiration and opportunity for all. The creative internationalist butterflies have been creating a media to counter the breadful British and billionaire press, controlled it seems by Tories, racists and fascists. Our internationalist media of the butterflies, blog, livestream, podcast, paint, create, build, our fluttering 24-hour counter to the brutish, brutal, racist, war-loving rags that dominate our newsstands, will win. We will create a country absolutely and totally far removed from the dystopian empire Murdoch and Richard Desmond seemingly want to help create. This year alone, the Awful Express has had 51 leading articles on its front pages exclaiming the disaster befalling us for saving people from death and destruction our Westminster British empirical government has supported and took part in and has instigated. The Daily Mail has had 46 such racist and disgraceful covers. The Telegraph and the Sun, the Guardian and the Times, the Independent and the Eye have all stoked up the hate that led to Brexit. And black people, Arab people, Polish people and Jews being hounded and beaten and killed on our streets. The Express only this week was telling its readership, a readership it seems to want to keep stupid with its lies, how immigrants will steal Christmas. Take some of your time and sign up to the Stop Funding Hate page on Facebook. And any of those products you deem necessary that advertise in these hate rags, use your power as a Scottish consumer and a Yes activist and contact that advertiser and tell them to pull out of these hate rags. I'll give the first corporation who wrenches itself away from the hatred of Cockroach Katie Hopkins and Murdoch and Mackenzie a free plug here on the contributor produced Ungagged. Our internationalist social and self-produced media isn't beholden to advertisers or proto-fascists like Murdoch or the dreadful Richard Desmond. We will, on Ungagged, tell our truths. Some of those truths are of the Dakotan Native Americans fighting to stop a huge pipeline from wrecking more of their sacred world, More of these truths are from black lives targeted by racist institutions and representatives. Some of those truths are of people jailed and on hunger strike across the world who protested against oppression and proto-fascism and actual fascism. Some of our truths are the Palestinians chased at gunpoint from their houses, their ancestral lands bulldozed and stolen by the Israeli state. And some of our truths are here in Scotland, a country seemingly kept poor by the awful abundance of oil, innovation, whisky and educated children. The internationalist butterflies like Indie Livestream will turn their pro-independence and passionate lenses to these causes, causes Scots, new and old, can and do embrace. Stories that we can help find conclusions for that will satisfy all but the exploiters and the oppressors. We are internationalist butterflies, like Grandfather Brian Quayle, who stops nuclear bombs, or to be more correct, stops the dangerous nuclear convoys that weave their way across England and Scotland, delivering destruction and placing us all in danger. We are internationalist butterflies. We welcome diversity. We stand on the shores of Ayrshire, Fife and the Western Isles and welcome with open arms the terrorised children of Syria and Iraq and Libya and Afghanistan and children from all of the hotbeds of Bush and Blair oil wars and the land-grabbing billionaires and oligarchs sailing the world in their Exocet-protected yachts. We are the internationalist butterflies. We want equity. We want to share our wealth, our talent and our land with those who want to help us create a better Scotland and a better world. Are you an internationalist yes butterfly yet? Stay tuned on Gag to hear our butterflies from across Scotland and indeed the world.
Feel those rays.
That was Hand of Dog and Cities. John McHarg, who is the drummer in Hand of Dog, is one of the founders of Yes 2. Another track from them, Something Caught Fire, after John explains Yes 2 and how it came about.
Hi, I'm John McHarg from Yes 2. Yes 2 was started originally as Yes 2 Dunblane on the 19th of September 2014, a day I'm sure we'll all remember and never forget. And it was started out of anger and desperation more than anything, really. It was such a disappointing day, such a disappointing result for all of us. But for myself and for thousands, hundreds of thousands of other people, that wasn't a result we expected. A lot of us, I think, just sat down in our living rooms or lay in our beds, totally shocked. And later on that day, on the 19th, I decided this is not acceptable, even though it was a democratic vote. For far too many of us, there was just far too much at stake to allow Westminster to continue to decide how our country was governed, how our resources were exploited. And when I say exploited, that certainly has been the case for many, many years now. So Yes 2 Dunblane was started, and I decided to contact other Yes groups, SNP groups, etc., that I had been campaigning with previously. But the sense of loss really was great. I personally felt it myself, but I had far too much drive, and more importantly, a child whose future I had to look after. And this specific reason for myself and so many other people definitely gave us the strength to continue. Also, we knew Better Together were lying. We knew all of those politicians were lying to us. And if they thought that we were just going to lie down and take it and allow them to continue the way they had been for so long, then it was them that was sadly mistaken. So from September to June 2015, I just continued to build the social media page and contact other groups, see if we could arrange stalls or small events to continue the Yes campaign. And with the meteoric rise of the SNP, we saw that definitely we had something to continue and to build on. Then, very importantly for ourselves, I had a meeting with Tony McCandless and Ian Aiken to discuss how we could build on our own group and definitely encourage more grassroots groups to show their strength of feeling for an independence cause. So Yes 2, as it's known now, as it's structured now, was born in June 2015. We went on that date in June from 400 members to now we're nearly at 50,000. Now, one important thing that did come out of the meeting with myself, Tony and Ian was the fact that at that time and at no time should the Yes campaign be used by anyone to make a profit. So we decided to register Yes 2 as a limited company and trademark our own Yes 2 logo, because people were selling products with the Yes 2 logo for their own personal gain. And as a result, we decided to invest a substantial amount of money in merchandise, t-shirts, badges, stickers, etc., to distribute to groups for free so that they could have something like their stalls that they could take donations for, that would assist in them paying for events that they wish to hold, even things like gazebos or tables to go out and do stalls. And one of the first groups that we contacted to do this was Yes Bikers. Now, this was the emergence of the idea we had for what we call seed funding pay it forward, in which the groups would go away, do stalls, organise events and take donations for t-shirts, etc., which would then in turn help them finance their group's activities. But importantly, if they returned some of the donations to us, we could give them even more merchandise, and we could also take part of the donations, which would pay for merchandise and for other groups. So these groups could go take donations, finance their groups, and then we could take some of those donations, buy more debt merchandise and give to other groups. And we're hoping, and in fact it has been extremely successful so far with the groups that have taken us up on the offer to seed fund pay it forward, as many Yes groups as we possibly can. The idea is that a large proportion of the Yes campaign helps to finance each other. Now, it's important to make it clear that Yes2 do not make any profit from this, and we're more than happy to let people see our accounts, but this has been significantly privately financed. To date, we do take donations as we need help ourselves, because despite the allegations, we simply don't have millionaires and sugar daddies that support us. And the amount of demand that we're getting from groups to assist them, really happy to do that. It's been very successful, and it's very encouraging when we go along to groups and do talks and explain this idea that we've got. You see the reaction on their face when they say, okay, how much do we owe you? And we say, you don't owe us anything. If you can pay us back some of the donations, then we can respond by giving you more merchandise. But we really, really want to connect all of the Yes campaign in this manner, even if it turns out to be a small manner. It's important as a grassroots campaign that we really are helping each other. We can't expect financial assistance from any of the political parties, and my personal opinion is would be that would be unfair to them, because at the moment they can't commit to a Yes campaign, which would really only give the unionists even more to moan about. It's quite ironic, however, that even though these political parties can't commit to a second NDRF, Yes to whatever campaign it is, that it is actually the unionist parties that hark on more about independence than anyone else. Personally, I think that the best and biggest recruiter for an independent campaign to date, and will continue to be so, is the Conservative and Unionist Party of Great Britain and their little branch office here in Scotland. So, as well as the seed funding initiative that we hope to continue and build, we have been involved quite a bit with marches and rallies and been invited by other groups to take part. And we had our most successful day on the 30th of July, which we were invited down to do. The Yes Bikers turned up, which I'm really proud to say I'm part of. It was a superb day, a superb show of strength and amazing optimism that we are definitely getting towards an independent Scotland far, far quicker than we could have ever imagined on the 19th of September 2014. Now, clearly, from that day in July, the result of that has been an explosion of activism and people organising events. Now, there's an event coming up on the 18th of September, organised by the Yes Movement in Glasgow Green, that Yes2 will be attending. We will be hosting Paul Kavanagh, Wee Ginger Doug, Common Wheel and the Yes Bikers, as we did at George Square. And on top of that, there's two other significant events that we're very, very pleased to be involved in. The first being the 22nd of October, organised by Unleash the Unicorn in Edinburgh. We have been in regular contact with him quite a lot recently to discuss the plans for that, the setup, and we're having a very formal meeting with them soon to just outline absolutely everything they're hoping to achieve on that day. And also next year, the Yes Bikers are planning a festival. Hopefully it will be the biggest indie festival to date, which they have a crowdfunder running for right now. They are hoping to have some of Scotland's best, finest musicians there, and they have indeed secured some really superb musicians to play at that. It does obviously, as all of these things do, depend on how much money they can raise to get this all organised. But if they are successful and they do organise a big campaign, it's not just about independence. They hope that they can encourage all demographics of Scottish society to come along. They're looking to raise a significant amount of money for Strathcarran Hospice, which is their chosen charity. They've done fundraising for already this year. Also, Christopher Graham, the guy that runs Yes Bikers, he's a previous no voter, and his story is fascinating, how he came to, after the referendum, understand what really was the case of Better Together, or should we say not the case. And personally, myself and Yes to support Chris and Yes Bikers, all the guys that are involved with that, quite a lot. So we're looking for everyone that's hopefully listening to this podcast to support both Yes Bikers and Unleash the Unicorn, because this is our movement. We own this movement together. We don't, regardless of whatever political party we are in that supports pro-independence, the grassroots have to be the people that get us there. It's not just that, we have to know unified before we go anywhere near a ballot box, when we're given a date of announcement. We have to know beforehand that together we are actually going to win whatever referendum on whatever date is set. Now, we know that Scotland's not going to wake up from that hangover we have after all of those amazing parties that we can tell our kids and grandkids about, that we're going to wake up to a utopia, that Scotland's going to wake up and be perfect. It's not. We've got a lot of damage to repair from what Westminster has done, and hopefully we'll have a lot of that already negotiated beforehand. So this campaign's been difficult for us. It's been upsetting. More recently, it's been very, very inspiring. We've got a lot of work ahead of us once we get independence. In fact, I was at a meeting at Forward Stenhousemuir and giving them a little chat the other night, and one thing that comes through almost every group that I go and speak to, or every group that comes and speaks to us, is we're looking for something different. We're not looking for things to continue in an independent Scotland as they did in a United Kingdom, because that's why we're wanting an independent Scotland. So we're now one of the best politically educated and active countries in the world, and we need to address now how we see our future working. But in the meantime, don't get angry, get active. I'd like to thank Ungagged for asking me to do this podcast, and thanks a lot for listening. Let's go out and get an independent Scotland, guys.
Yeah. I'm Deborah Torrance, a member of the SNP branch here in Mogai. A decade ago, I first got involved with politics. I was in college, I'd just bought my first flat. I was trying to be a responsible member of my community and an actual grown-up. I was over in the south side and stopped by the SNP constituents' office to see if there was anything I could get involved in. As it happened, there was a petition going to get the United Kingdom to agree to a referendum on Scottish independence. I'll be honest, I thought my efforts at college were futile. Although I got everyone I spoke with to sign up, even if they were against the idea of independence at the time, they believed in democracy. I didn't believe a referendum would ever happen. Fast forward a good few years and we had our opportunity. Or did we just have a trial run? The last time anybody was asked about the relationship Scotland is in with the rest of the United Kingdom was 1979. We weren't even asked in 1707 since feudal lairds reigned supreme. Now we just have unelected lairds reigning supreme for $300 a day in the House of Lords. Since our IndyRef in 2014, however, a whole heap has changed. We have some extra lairds in the second house of wooden panels and leather upholstery. Nothing to do with Tory gerrymandering, we are assured by the Tory government. We have had another referendum, this time all of the UK took part. The question was about the relationship of the United Kingdom and the European Union. As it happens, and as is the democratic setup in the UK, Scotland voted to remain, but as a whole, Britain decided to Brexit the EU. We also got a shiny new Prime Minister, who's another Tory, so not all that shiny. We have, however, not begun the processes to leave the EU. Article 50 has yet to be triggered and our departing PM totally washed his pork loving hands of it. Labour got a new leader, or two, maybe three. We lost football fan Jim and got Casey Dugdale, and we lost Millibanders and have Corbyn mania. Or do we? I can't keep up. We got a new First Minister too, the excellent Nicola Sturgeon. Some other stuff happened. The bottom fell out the oil barrel. Pensions are a bit of a contentious subject. Ask the hashtag waspies. Although we did run the whole country on wind power alone for a month or something, and we now have the world's first large-scale tidal stream power generation farm thingy. They're monstrous. A bit like Tory government's prolonged attack on the scroungers, note my air quotations, and seeming hatred for junior doctors and European citizens living here. What is the Tories' problem? Why, the obvious. Lots happened all over the world too, terror attacks, Syria's bombardment, Ukrainian unrest, Indonesia instability, South America turmoil. Hundreds of stuff, too much to listen to this podcast. So essentially, we are in limbo. But so is the whole world. A wee bit of it though, Scotland, where only just over half the voters in hashtag IndyRef1 voted to remain part of the UK. Not the defining result many had hoped for, but we must respect the result. But over 60% voted to remain part of the EU, yet we are Brexiting anyway. What a weird situation we are in. What is the end game here? How can we rectify this odd parallel universe where 2 years ago I was dreaming of a new modern independent nation, taking its first steps to economic liberty, facing all the challenges it would bring, but also grasping the opportunities? What have we instead? This dystopian future where Tories are talking about repealing the Human Rights Act, destroying the welfare state and poor folks' lives with continued austerity, dragging us out of the EU, whilst we're moving up on the arms dealer tech end total knockout championship leagues, and Donald Trump might actually become the President of America. And yet, talk of another independence referendum is what's radical these days. I say, in this crazy interwoven global nuclear age, no matter how you voted last time or what party you support, can you begin to see how our small nation needs its own voice in the world more than ever? Your voice! Our voice! The people of Scotland's voice!
Wow! 1.8 million people surrounded on all sides. Refugees since 48, since 67 occupied. The only reason they're not starving is down to the UN. Most have never left, they're stuck in the lion's den. The most crowded place on earth, and there they'll stay. They can't visit cousins a half hour's drive away. Drones overhead constantly. Who will die tomorrow? A daily mystery in Gaza. The settlers moved out, fighter jets moved in. In Gaza, there's just no way that you can win. You can't take out a copter with an antiquated gun. You're just a target sitting in the sun, waiting for your death to come raining from the sky, where the end really is nigh. You can hear a sonic boom and see a flashing light every hour of the day, every hour of the night in Gaza. There are no shelters, nowhere you can hide. Life is nothing like it is on the other side. There's nothing post about the traumatic stress. There's never more, usually less. And still some people wonder, they insist on asking why anyone would be so mad as to reply, so mad as to think that it might make sense to lob some missiles over the fence from Gaza. From Gaza. From Gaza.
That was David Rovics on his track Gaza. Over the past few days, Facebook and Twitter has been filled with memes, signs and banners and video of protesters chanting oil kills. Native American activists are trying to stop construction of a North Dakota pipeline that will desecrate sacred land and pollute water. The protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline have drawn international attention, sparking a renewal of Native American activism and prompting the US government to block its construction on federal land, even as the company building the line expressed its commitment to the project last Tuesday. Ruth Hopkins, a Native American writer and a columnist for Indian Country Today Media Network and co-founder of LastRealIndians.com, explains what has been happening.
Han Madaki Api. My name is Ruth Hopkins. My Dakota name is Chankudutui, Red Road Woman. I am Lakota and Dakota. We are the Osheti Shakowi, the Great Sioux Nation. I was born on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, and right now, we are fighting for our lives. The Dakota Access Pipeline was originally slated to pass north of the state capital of Bismarck, North Dakota. But after it was deemed too dangerous to the city's water supply, it was moved next to the reservation on Lakota Treaty lands. The Dakota Access Pipeline threatens the water supply of Sitting Bull's people and millions of non-natives who live downstream along the Missouri River. Construction of the pipeline will also destroy ancient sacred burial sites along its path. In April 2016, Sacred Stone Camp was established in hopes of stopping construction of the pipeline. Our youth ran all the way to Washington, D.C. to tell President Obama that we wanted construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline stopped. Still, Dakota Access came, and they were protected by a legion of local law enforcement. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe requested an injunction against Dakota Access due to the fact that they had not completed a thorough environmental impact statement nor consulted with the tribes. We put out a call for solidarity to all who would join us. Soon we were flooded with resolutions and letters of support from Native American tribes throughout North and South America. People began arriving in droves. The Apache, the Comanche, Aztecs, Indigenous Hawaiians, and hundreds of other tribal nations, along with every other color and creed, have stood with us at camp. For the first time in more than 100 years, all tribes of the Osheti Shakowi were once again reunited in a singular purpose. Thanks to social media, the message of hashtag No Dakota Access Pipeline spread far and wide across the globe. People sent money, sleeping bags, tents, and all manner of supplies requested. Medics, healers, tribal leaders, medicine men, congressmen, and Black Lives Matter came to join us. Within the camps, our numbers swelled to more than 8,000. Such a gathering is unprecedented in modern history. Although spirits remain high and our unity has made us strong, we are experiencing hardship for opposing the pipeline. Early on, during a heat wave, the state of North Dakota cut off water supplies and emergency resources to those at the camps. Local law enforcement set up a military-style roadblock that hindered travel of local Native residents and camp inhabitants. The blockade also acted as an economic sanction, hurting Native-owned businesses in the area. The governor of North Dakota, who calls us the Indians, along with local media, has demonized water protectors, spreading lies about us having pipe bombs and threatening law enforcement officers. We have been steadfast in being peaceful and nonviolent. These lies were later recanted, but the damage was already done. This propaganda has provoked racial attacks against Natives throughout the Dakotas, on and offline. On Friday, September 2, 2016, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe submitted documentation to the court concerning the discovery of burial sites directly in the path of the pipeline. The very next morning, Dakota Access moved construction to the location of those burial sites and began to bulldoze them, grave markers and all. Water protectors on the front line implored them to stop, putting their bodies in the path of Dakota Access machines. It was then that Dakota Access private security mercenaries began to antagonize our people. Dozens were pepper sprayed. Dakota Access private security sicked vicious attack dogs in the crowds. Mercenaries laughed as dogs tore into women and children. None of these private security assailants have been charged for injuring innocent civilians on site. But local law enforcement officials have issued warrants for Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, who participated in nonviolent direct action on the front lines, as well as Democracy Now! Producer Amy Goodman, who shot viral footage of the dog attacks. There have been 38 arrests of water protectors so far. Based on the destruction of sacred sites, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe went to court to ask for a temporary restraining order. This restraining order was granted in part and denied in part, so sacred sites were still in danger. Finally, last Friday, a federal judge rendered his decision regarding the injunction. It was denied. We were heartbroken. But only moments later, the Obama administration stepped in. The Department of Justice, the Department of Interior, and the Army Department released a joint statement that effectively halted construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline until prior decisions could be reviewed. North Dakota's senators and congressmen support the pipeline. They've refused to hear the pleas of Native voters who oppose it. Presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has also refused to address the Dakota Access Pipeline, despite the story's widespread dissemination throughout the mainstream media at this point. Former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders has actively supported Standing Rock and has introduced legislation intended to deny Dakota Access Pipeline easements until an environmental impact statement is completed. This story is far from over. While the administrative review provides us with a short reprieve, it doesn't guarantee that the Dakota Access Pipeline will not be built. Camps are now preparing for the long haul. Winter is on its way. It's up to us to protect the next seven generations. To support us, donate to the official No Dakota Access Pipeline Fund at standingrock.org. Follow Sacred Stone Camp and Red Warrior Camp on Facebook and Twitter. And please continue to pay attention to the events surrounding Standing Rock and its opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline as they develop. Spread awareness. There is also dozens of solidarity actions happening around the world this week. Please go to one near you. Keep us in your prayers. Wopila, many thanks for your support.
Hey, it's recording.
Travel Cat Day Center.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Myself a good woman, but I just didn't treat her right. Now I was always leaving, living a party life. True love was waiting for me. I was much too blind to see, till she told me she would leave me, and I said said that's all right with me. No, and now she's gone. I realized I lost the best thing there is. And my pride keeps telling me, let your loss be your lesson. Heaven knows I miss her loving. Heaven knows how much I cry. Just to think she had left me. And I know the reason why. I could tell she had been crying. Didn't seem to bother me. 'Cause I know there's no one blinder than a fool who just couldn't see. No, and now she's gone. I realize I lost the best thing there. And my pride keeps telling me, let your loss be your lesson.
Paisley bass band Travel Cat and Let Your Loss.
Hi, I'm David McGowran from IndependenceLive.net, and I'd just like to thank everyone on behalf of the team for all the support you've given us. Since 2013, we have produced over 2,000 hours worth of live events, public meetings, interviews, outdoor demos, and much more besides. IndependenceLive.net have pioneered the new style of citizen journalism, bringing you the reality on the ground the mainstream media won't. Check out our archive, go to independencelive.net.
Hi, this is Derek Stewart McPherson, and you're listening to Ungagged. Next up, my latest single, Green Grow the Rashes, by Robert Burns, ably assisted by my good friends Annie Coyne and Mark Doherty.
Oh, but care on every hand. And every hour that passes, oh, and signifies the world, oh man, it was nae for the lassies, oh. Green grow the rushes, oh, green grow the rushes, oh, the sweetest hours that ever I spent were spent among the lassies, oh. While they race, may riches chase, and riches still may fly them, oh. And though at last they catch them fast, their heirs can ne'er enjoy them, oh. Green grow the rushes, oh. Green grow the rushes, oh. The sweetest hours that I spent were spent among the lassies, oh. But give me a canty out of team, my arms are put, my dearie, oh. The worldly cares and worldly men may all get up so teary, oh. Green grow the rushes, oh. Green grow the rushes, oh. The sweetest hours that I spent were spent among the lassies, oh.
Spent among the last
Nazis, oh.
If you're a pig, then I know can follow you. You're probably nice, that's what I think. And you're no worse than a dirty lady that's got knickers and sends a link. No clicker links. Oh, I didn't see you there. Hello again, folks. Red Wraith making your ears bleed with my words of wisdom. So are we still in the summer independence? Being Scottish independence that we're talking about is no easy to know. We're not famous for having long, hot summers. And we're used to having a cause for India ignored by most of the mainstream media. During the last couple of days of the India ref, and because I was worried about the lack of coverage we was getting, I was moved to write a wee poem in support of an I vote. Although the day has come and all disappointingly gone, I think our words are still relevant. Especially when we're gearing up for IndyRef 2. So if you'd indulge me, here go. It's called Yes to Independence. I hope you're going to listen to what I have to say. I know much time to change your mind when nearing to that day. My colours knelt upon a mast, my vote will go one way. I'm saying yes to independence. I shouldn't have to tell you, but I feel I have to warn. There's loads of Margaret Thatchers just waiting to be born. So free is new, it's up to you. An awful is just wrong. I'm saying yes to independence. I can't get my head round why you wouldn't care to leave our wains to Westminster. It really isn't fair. We'll have a chance to save them. The Tories be nae mair if we all say yes to independence. Think about the future and know yourself for once. A bloodless revolution nae mair led a merry dance. There's plenty other countries that'd love to have a chance. I'm shouting yes to independence. Come 18th of September, our future's in our hands. No hedge or bet, just grow a set. We'll gain back your land. Your country really needs you. It's time to make a stand. So come on, just say yes to independence. No baddie. Maybe no matter material, but you like the herd worse. I kinda think, with that line about Margaret Thatcher, I was wee a wee bit prophetic, or pathetic, as my critics would say. Theresa May's gearing up to be as much of a scary Tory as all the other Tory prime monsters that have gone afore her. But while my poem probably focused too much on being negative, I think it may be important to be positive. After thinking that losing the IndyRef was the end of things, I now see it makes our starting point even more strong. We know what they're going to throw at us. We have an answer for all the scaremongering. As one of my pals off of Twitter, Mr. Malky, is always saying, we each of us just need to convert one former no voter to join in the yes camp and in the bag. Now, I'm no suggesting you read them all my wee poem, but no be scared to talk to folk. I mean, as a 10-year-old subverter of the Queen's English once say, what can go wrong?
Why? Futurologists, filmmakers, novelists, and artists made many weird and wonderful predictions about the 20th and 21st centuries, yet none foretold the inception of the internet. This global system of interconnected computer networks has matured over the past two decades into the planet's most ubiquitous and influential media format, linking billions together and reshaping their lives on a daily basis. There's countless quantities to marvel at when it comes to the internet, yet one of the most remarkable things about this omnipresent medium is the way it grants mankind access to an almost infinite quantity of information in a matter of seconds. Once upon a time, if you wanted to study about a particular period of history, learn more about the life of Charles Darwin, or brush up on your Shakespeare, then you'd have to venture to your nearest bookstore or library in the hope that they provided the literature that you required. These days, if you want admittance to such information, then all you need to do is take out your phone and ask Google to dish up the knowledge you need. And of course, it's not just history, Darwin or Shakespeare that's on offer, but everything from the most common of subjects to the most infrequent. Ever wondered how poultry communicates? Well, wonder no more, as Google has the answer. Fancy finding out the complete history of the Tel Aviv bus station? Well, there's a podcast for that. Do you possess an undying desire to master the Klingon language? A YouTube channel will assist with all. Access to any and every piece of information ever conjured by our species since the dawn of time now sits in the palms of many. And it's this abundant availability of information which also means we now have access to plentiful quantities of news outlets. Once upon a time, the news agents and airwaves of Great Britain were dominated by Mr. Murdoch's tabloid empire, the Daily Mail, and other outlets owned by the media establishment. The mainstream media oligopoly ruled over our lands, beaming into the minds of citizens with little else matching such size or influence to challenge it. News stories, think pieces, and gossip were fed to its consumers, insidiously impressing ideologies and agendas upon an unsuspecting public. Pro-capitalism, pro-Western, anti-immigrant, anti-welfare, anti-EU, neoliberal rhetoric raised nations to believe any other outlook or belief was wrong. It was an all-you-can-eat buffet of spin, lies and propaganda, dished up daily in a bid to fuel the agendas of their billionaire owners. The dawn of the internet has resulted in the arrival of innumerable accounts of easy-access alternatives, offering something different to those mainstream narratives which once drown out all other viewpoints. The birth of blogs, podcasts, YouTube channels and social media accounts meant that individuals and outlets with far less capital and power than the media mogul Murdoch empire can now have their say, distributing stories from fresh and unique angles. Mainstream traditional media still exists, of course, and has adapted to the digital era during the rise of the internet. Yet it now has plenty of competition that not only offers alternative perspectives on news stories, but also has the ability to call out the establishment media when facts are incorrect or twisted. Naturally, the existence of alternative online news outlets doesn't eradicate the problem of news having agendas. Individuals are just as likely to have their own ideological motives as the mainstream media tycoons. Whether they realise it or not, no matter how unbiased their intentions may be, every person on this planet has an ideology and outlook which they try to imprint on others. The difference today, however, is these agendas and rhetorics come in many shapes and sizes. The internet allows news to be consumed from all angles of the political, philosophical and ideological spectrum. Multiple outlets means today we live in a world where countless worldviews are accessible to us, showing us that the Murdoch and Daily Mail viewpoints aren't the only perspectives available. Many will argue that the problem with this new age of abundant news is the amount of misinformation that comes along with it. And yes, we are now living in a period of history where half-truths are shared and perceived as certainty by those none the wiser. Memes and articles lacking sources or proof litter the walls of social media accounts, accepted as legitimate by their consumers with little thought put into them. Except misinformation and spinning truths has always been around in any medium. The idea that false stories and fabricated information is solely caused by the internet is almost as ludicrous a notion as about 99% of the stories written in the Daily Mail. Lies and false facts are littered throughout all mediums, no matter how old or new they may be. A recent example of this in regards to tabloid newspapers would be the June 2016 EU referendum. During the run-up to this vote, a majority of mainstream newspapers sided with the Leave camp, taking it upon themselves to inform readers that leaving Europe would dramatically curb immigration levels, free up £350 million a week for NHS funding, and save £2 billion on energy bills. These so-called truths struck a chord with the public imagination, and on June the 23rd, Britain voted to leave the European Union, only to then be informed almost immediately afterwards that these promises could not be met. As UKIP and many in the Tory party did, the mainstream media fabricated facts to steer a political referendum's outcome. The tabloids are just as guilty of spreading false information as any blog, YouTube channel, or podcast. The only difference between the internet and traditional media is that the internet gives folks more power to debunk any of these fabrications. Comment sections below articles are ripe breeding grounds for readers and skeptics to dig their claws into falsehoods and sourceless claims. Furthermore, easy access to search engines means that readers can now check the web regarding stories and lack of sources if need be. Whilst the traditional tabloids could once puke up lies without heckles discrediting their claims in footnotes, the internet gives consumers the ability to either call out falsehoods or discover one after consumption. Just think of the amount of times you've watched an incredulous YouTube video only to then scroll down the comments and see someone explaining how and why it's fake. Another beauty of the online media, coupled with the advent of smartphones, is its power to make citizens into journalists. When major news stories used to break, camera crews would hurry to the scene. These days, however, any civilian finding themselves caught within the centre of a breaking story can take out their mobile phone and tweet, film, or blog about the unfolding events surrounding them. These days, first-person and immediate accounts are commonplace, providing in-depth details of unfolding stories whilst granting any member of society the power to become a journalist. News is no longer an account written by those fortunate enough to work within the media. It can now be documented and catalogued by you, me, or any other fool with a smartphone and a data plan. Of course, the world of online news isn't perfect. Freedom of infinite ideologies means that extremists can now vent their irrational hatred through the guise of the news. Permitting platforms to all includes the hateful. But then again, the presence of such views allows us to see what the enemy is thinking, so to speak. While racists, homophobes, and other bigots once shared the reasons behind their illogical revulsions between one another, we can now see the skewered reasoning behind their theories, which gives us freedom to debate, study, prepare for, and call out all of their inconsistencies. Having said all this, another concern regarding online news, particularly in recent years, is the problem of the echo chamber. While the opportunity to debate and understand differing ideological groups reigns large, algorithms and social networking sites are now beginning to usher us into an era where the internet may well restrict us from alternative viewpoints. An example of this would be Facebook, which now adopts an algorithm that only shows stories on users' news feeds based on the content they've previously viewed. Seeing as the content users most likely view are going to be based on pre-existing worldviews, it means ultimately those users will not be exposed to stories or ideas differing from those they're already familiar with. While such systems permit users to avoid content which may upset or antagonize them, it also means a majority of what they consume will most likely confirm and strengthen biases already held by them. Surrounding yourself with ideas you largely agree with often prevents individuals from developing or obtaining new ones. Instead of having outlooks challenged, their intellectual notions are validated by a flow of incoming data, informing them that what they already believe in is correct. In a medium where content can be called out in comment sections, challenged by numerous alternative outlets, and dissected in blog posts, hindering users from seeing anything other than the things that they're used to seeing seems like a step backwards. Despite suffering from the same misinformation problem that traditional forms of media endure, plus the recent habit of tailoring content on social media accounts, the internet is home to an endless variety of news sources. Traditional media still wields power in this day and age, of course, and as we said on the 23rd of June, their words still do influence the actions of many. As the size, complexity, and inspiration of the internet forever expands, so too does the influence of online media. The citizens of Earth now have control to describe world events from their own personal perspectives, encounter many opinions alien from their own on a daily basis, call out lies told by others, and read up on incidents from a countless number of angles. Alternative outlooks and the abundance of information may have its problems. However, living in a world where Murdoch and his cronies aren't the sole monopoly of news is a world slightly more hopeful than the one that came before it. Let us hope that as time moves forward, online media can continue to strengthen the voices of those who were once drowned out by the screams of the traditional media.
Same old voice that said that same old one. Hello, this is Chuck Hamilton coming to you again from Chattanooga, Tennessee in the USA. With regards to the recent rebuke by Parliament of David Cameron for the intervention in Libya, I think the MPs were quite correct to point out the disorganization and the lack of follow-up. One of the main problems with interventions by the West is that most share those faults. However, I have to counter the idea that the intervention in 2011 led to the current civil war in Libya. People tend to forget or ignore, because it is inconvenient, the fact that there was a civil war going on in Libya at the time, one begun by the Gaddafi regime against his own people when they came out in the streets, like the citizens of Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, and Algeria were doing or had done at the time. His forces' response was to fire into the crowds. While there is no question that the action taken in 2011 should have been more coherent and included measures to help the country put itself back together in the aftermath rather than just handing everything over to the strongest warlords, if nothing at all had been done, the bloodshed in Libya would have far exceeded that in Syria, and Europe would be wishing that the refugee crisis were at the level it is now rather than what it would have otherwise been. As for the current civil war, the one that started in 2014, yes, some of this involves leftovers from 2011, but it's mostly due to meddling by forces in the region, with Qatar along with Turkey and Sudan supporting the Tripoli-based General National Congress led by the Muslim Brotherhood, and the forces loyal to it with UAE, that's United Arab Emirates, along with Russia and Egypt supporting the Tobruk-based Council of Deputies and the forces loyal to it. The General National Congress was originally the coalition government established after the revolution, in which the Muslim Brotherhood were a minority. They gained a majority by having a law passed forbidding everyone who held any position in the Gaddafi regime at any level from holding office, similar to what Paul Bremer did after the invasion of Iraq. They did this by having armed militias invade ministries and offices demanding the law be passed. Once they were in power, they approved Sharia law being imposed on the country, with severe repression of women's rights, which for some reason is always the first place that religious fundamentalists such as that go. And make no mistake, the Muslim Brotherhood are not moderate, quote-unquote, Islamists. And that includes the ones in Egypt, the ones in Yemen, the ones in Turkey, who go by the name of AKP. The mandate for the GNC was supposed to end at the close of 2013, but the Brotherhood refused, instead voting themselves a year's extension. In mid-February, General Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, ordered the GNC to conduct the elections for the permanent Council of Deputies that was supposed to replace the GNC as prescribed by law. But the GNC ignored him. However, he gave them 3 months before launching the second civil war. A week after he attacked first, the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated GNC announced elections for June, which they, for that June, that was June 2014, the elections that they lost. To the surprise of almost no one, they then refused to recognize the election. In Egypt, events happened in much the same way. Though somewhat more low-key, Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood allies in the Egyptian parliament were on their way to establishing the same kind of rule in that country. Like the MB in Libya, he ruled autocratically by decree, ignored court orders, and issued a proclamation that his decrees could not be challenged. What happened in June 2013, therefore, was a revolution, but it was a revolution followed immediately by a military coup against that revolution by the same armed forces which had backed it at first. The series of events in both cases is much more complex and convoluted than I've made it sound, but I only have so much time. I'm trying to illustrate several things here. First, just because an individual or group is elected democratically does not make them democratic, especially if they just ride the streetcar as far as they need and then get off. Second, when elected officials betray democracy as badly as in these two cases, they deserve to be removed. Third, most of us on the left in the West need to look carefully at such situations before making knee-jerk comments about Western imperialism on behalf of figures and groups such as these, merely because they are quote-unquote, any Western. Otherwise, we might find ourselves in the position of Hugo Chavez when he embraced Ahmadinejad of Iran as a paragon of anti-imperialism, and in doing so lost a huge amount of credibility regarding his own politics, putting everything he had achieved at risk, a mistake the fruits of which we are seeing in Venezuela today. We also run the risk of being useful tools for folks as nasty as Vladimir Putin. Speaking of nasty bastards elected democratically then betraying democracy, I have to say that De Gaulle has piled up a rather impressive body count. Speaking, of course, of Roderick Duterte of the Philippines. 3,000 dead since the election results were announced just this past June. That's equal to the death total in the 6 counties of Northeast Ulster during the 30 years of the Troubles, or in the attacks here in America on 9/11. When I was over there in the Philippines in the late 1980s and early 90s, and he was mayor of Davao, he was one of the two nastiest pieces of work that I knew of there. Regarding the former hitman of the Davao Death Squad currently testifying before the Philippine Congress, I have no doubt every word he says about De Gaulle is truthful and accurate. The other person of whom in the Philippines I was speaking was then Major, later Major General Jovito Paparin of the AFP's Special Operations Battalion. His troops were responsible for gross tortures and murders in the name of counterinsurgency against the New People's Army while I was there, including one of my in-laws named Bon Concepcion. At the time I was at Clark Air Base, the SOT was stationed in San Fernando, Pampanga, and its methods were so brutal that the U.S. Army Special Forces Detachment at Clark pulled enough strings to get him moved out of the area. Turning to Scotland, one of the fears that I've read about is that with Brexit, Scots and other people in the UK will lose visa-free travel. I'd like to remind everybody that visa-free travel falls under a separate treaty, the one called Schengen, out of which UK, Ireland, the Isle of Man, and the Channel Islands have already opted out. Two things here. First, the warnings of refugee hordes overrunning the country as long as it was still in the EU were a false flag. Second, 4 non-EU countries in Europe, Switzerland, Norway, Iceland, and Liechtenstein, are part of Schengen, so Scotland should be able to do the same after winning independence. In closing, let me say kudos to Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish Parliament for banning fracking. Thank you. Igar Laha, Alba Gubra.